Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 38 people now dead and hundreds more wounded after bombings in Brussels last week. European security services are scrambling to figure out the web of ISIS networks on the continent. This is the third major ISIS attack in the heart of Europe in over a year. With 28 member states, porous borders, overtaxed intelligence agencies, and turf rivalries, how will Europe get ahead of these attacks? This hour on Point, European security and ISIS. You can join us on air or online with this conversation. Is always on. What's the way forward for Europe here? What can they do to stop these terror attacks? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. But first, we want to take a look at the deadly Taliban bombing in Lahore, Pakistan on Easter Sunday. Joining me from Islamabad is Kamran Haider, correspondent with Bloomberg News. Kamran Haider, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being with us. What is the latest death toll and injured toll there?
Thanks, Tom. Now we have the latest figure of 72 dead and more than 300 people wounded. The figure may go up of casualties, the deaths, because few are still in critical condition.
We've seen reports that Jamaat... We've seen reports that Jamaat al-Ahrar, you pronounce it for us, this Taliban splinter group has said they had targeted Christians with this blast on Easter Sunday in Lahore. Is there any second guessing of that? Does that seem to be indeed the target, the motivation? Hello, Kamran, are you there? We must have lost that line already, and I'm sorry for that because we wanted to give full acknowledgement to the terrible losses in Lahore and Pakistan today. We will find another opportunity to come back and look at what exactly has gone on there and, importantly, why this Taliban group affiliated a couple of years ago with ISIS. And, of course, you heard there, 79 dead and many, many more wounded in Lahore, many children among them. And this Taliban splinter group claiming that they had deliberately targeted Christians who were in the park for kind of observation of Easter Sunday, families together on Easter Sunday, that suicide bombing going off by a swing set in a very big and open public park in Lahore, Pakistan. With us now from Paris, following the latest out of Belgium and Brussels, is Angela Charlton. She's Associated Press Bureau Chief for France, Belgium, and North Africa, just back from Brussels. Angela, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Take us to the latest numbers out of Brussels. We've just heard 38. Is that where it stands now, death toll?
We believe so. One outstanding question we have is whether that figure includes the suicide bombers. So that's about what we're hearing. We still have about 100 people in the hospital.
And what's the latest on arrests? We've heard repeated reports of arrests over the weekend.
Yes, there have been several arrests over the weekend in at least four countries. So interestingly, three of those arrests appear to be linked to a separate plot that the French government says was planning some kind of attack in France. There's someone arrested in France, someone in Belgium, and someone in the Netherlands, all in that case. Now, the question with this is whether there could ultimately be some link to that same network that was behind the Paris and Brussels attacks, whether it's something totally different, or whether the authorities could be exaggerating a bit because they were so caught off guard by what happened in Brussels last week.
What about the ISIS connection here? In the Charlie Hebdo attack, there was a kind of tangential connection. In Paris last fall, a much more robust connection. What about the bombings last week and the motivation in ISIS?
The bombings last week seem to fit more in the Paris prism, both because they have several common characters and because of the way ISIS has claimed responsibility and had a fair number of details they announced about the attack that had not yet emerged publicly at that point. So it's a pretty clear demonstration by them that they are able to carry out this kind of thing abroad. Now, at the same time, this is coming when they're suffering somewhat in Iraq and Syria.
What are the latest numbers? When in Europe, security people talk about the number of returned ISIS fighters. Of course, it could be many more sympathizers, I suppose, but just returned fighters. Where does that number stand in the estimates?
I don't actually have the current exact figure. I do know that our reporting last week determined that ISIS has trained about 400 people currently in Europe, effectively sleeper agents who are ready and trained to carry out some kind of an attack or play a role in some kind of an attack.
What about access to arms in Europe? We tend to think of it as much more difficult than in the United States, and yet explosives keep emerging, and for that matter, weapons.
It varies widely country to country, and that's where Europe's open borders come to play here. It's very easy. I travel back and forth from Paris to Brussels all the time, and I take a train and a car, and mm-hmm. I'm pretty much never checked, including when I just got back. So there are, in the criminal underworld, there are a fair number of weapons coming, notably from the Balkans. That can get through. It's still overall more difficult to get weaponry legally than in the United States, but on the black market, it's definitely out there. And then the explosives material that you mentioned, a lot of that the material we're finding, for example, for THCP is relatively easy to get on the open market.
We've all seen today the memorial in Brussels where I'm not sure how to describe them, right-wing, far-right-wing, or Nazi protesters against terrorism sort of stormed through this more peace-oriented memorial. Describe what happened there, Angela.
That was a pretty surprising manifestation of this anti-migrant and far-right sentiment. As you said, this is a site that peace activists, but also many Brussels residents, had transformed into a sort of symbol of international solidarity. There were flags from around the world. There were messages written in chalk every day in all kinds of languages, candles. And people had wanted to hold a big solidarity rally yesterday, just as they had in Paris after the Charlie Hebdo and kosher market attacks a year ago. The authorities banned that rally, but instead these far-right militants came out and had their own unauthorized demonstration. They ended up clashing with police. They shouted a lot of angry anti-migrant and fairly violent sentiments. It was a small group, as often happens with this. It was a few hundred people, but it certainly had an effect, and it's not the kind of thing we've seen in Belgium before. We've seen it to some degree in France and Germany, but this is a new development that is obviously of concern to both the authorities and the majority, the peaceful majority.
I mean, the strain of these attacks clearly can open political and even cultural divides. They're just logistical problems as well. The airport closed still, I think, is supposed to open tomorrow. What are Belgians and other travelers doing? Is it the whole airport shut down or just part of it?
The whole airport is shut down, and this is an airport that has 600 flights a day, 23 million passengers a year. And what's happening tomorrow is they're just going to do some testing, but they're not actually opening it up to proper traffic yet. And that may take some time before that happens. So what people are doing for now is taking trains or cars to neighboring France or the Netherlands to get out. But it's added a lot of time to the journey.
But people are flying through Brussels all over Europe and around the world. I mean, it must be a major sort of break in the network of flight access for people from all over the place.
It's huge, and the Paris airport is getting a lot of the the spillover, lots of flights have been changed. So obviously anyone who's traveling in the area, please do check. And as you say, I think the Belgian government said some 40 nationalities of people were among those killed or injured.
Angela, we're going to look at the security implications of what has just happened here. But how do you see the balance of response in Belgium and beyond? People saying, how much of it is we have to tighten up our security services and security surveillance and policing versus we have to fix the problem of alienation of a population within our borders living among us?
I would say the authorities are cognizant of both, but there's definitely more of an emphasis on the former. The Belgians had even last year recognized a lot of the problems in their system and how it's not at all adapted for the current terrorist threat. And they had started making some changes, but these are deep changes that are being made to the entire structure of this country and its law enforcement. And then, of course, each European country has a slightly different system. And so with these open borders and with the current threat, notably the fact that a lot of these attackers are European citizens, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And so I think the focus now is, in some countries it's on a crackdown, in other countries it's really more on the coordination, improving that coordination among European governments.
It's hard to know how to gauge Europeans' response from the American remove. At this point, is it your sense that Belgians, French, Europeans feel under attack or in some sense at war with or being warred on by ISIS?
I think it's more that this kind of threat has become the new normal. I think in Paris, notably last year, the Charlie Hebdo and kosher market attacks definitely marked a turning point. And people have gone back to their daily lives, but we're all looking over our shoulders a bit. There's a sense that it could happen again anytime, anywhere. It's worth remembering, too, that European countries, including France and others, had experience with terrorist attacks in the 90s, in the 80s, in the 70s, in their big cities, unexpected, hard to predict. So it's not a massive war on terrorism kind of feel, at least not for the moment.
But one wonders how many on this scale can be absorbed with that attitude. Angela Charlton is Associated Press Bureau Chief for France, Belgium, North Africa, just back from Brussels and with us. Angela, we're grateful for your time today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking today at Europe's security future, how it's going to cope with a problem that can look out of control after the Brussels attacks that have now left 38 dead and hundreds wounded. You can join us this hour. How will Europe get a handle on this? And how do 28 countries create a net without holes or many to stop terror? Can Europe cooperate to that degree to get the job done? If ISIS is determined to strike in Europe and the people are there, how do you stop them? Talking with the AP on Thursday, this was Rob Wainwright, director of Europol, saying the attacks in Belgium show ISIS is increasingly targeting Europe.
This is the most serious terrorist threat we've faced in Europe for at least a decade. And even in the last 6 months, I think, we're faced by a determined new strategy by Islamic State to take the fight to Europe, to our streets.
That sounds no fun, and we saw that last week. Here's French Prime Minister Emmanuel Valls speaking at a press conference about those attacks in Brussels last week, interpreted here by Ruptly TV, talking about the future of European security.
In the coming years, we will have to invest more and more in our security systems, in manpower, in technical means and resources, and we will have to do this at national level and at European level. We will have to improve cooperation between the member states.
A new scale of effort required here, says the French Prime Minister. With us now from Geneva in Switzerland is Christina Choi-Liang, advisor for the Emerging Security Challenges Program at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Looks at international security and terrorism. Christina Choi-Liang, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
And with us via Skype from New York is Clint Watts, fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, focuses on terrorism, intelligence, senior fellow at the George Washington Center on Cyber and Homeland Security, former FBI special agent working on the Joint Terrorism Task Force. His piece in Foreign Policy magazine last week is "A Wounded Islamic State is a Dangerous Islamic State." Clint Watts, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Christina, let me come first to you. We just heard Rob Wainwright, director of Europol, saying that Europe is now facing a determined new strategy by the Islamic State to take the fight to Europe, to our streets, he said. Do you agree? Is there clear evidence that that is what's going on, Christina?
Absolutely. If you just look at Europol's 2016 report, it basically talked about how the Islamic State's modus operandi has changed, that it really has now a structured command, a structure to plan and coordinate special forces-style operations. And it's, you know, it is now, because it's increasingly using criminal resources and working with petty criminals and even high-level criminals, they're able to source, you know, weapons of choice, which is their AK-47, but also they're able to build bombs. So we are really facing a very well-trained and strategic new threat.
We've heard the number 400 put out as the number of perhaps returned fighters or those in service of ISIS within Europe. How does that number look to you? Is it a meaningful number? Do you imagine more or less?
It's really difficult to come up with numbers because the problem we have in Europe is that we are not able to even identify returnees who are coming back. Our intelligence resources are not sufficient to actually identify the number who are coming back. So some of them could have been returned and we are not even sure where they are within our countries.
Clint Watts, you've written about this, and very recently, how do you see the ISIS goal? If this is now a concerted series of attacks, what's the goal, Clint?
I think it's a natural progression from having success in Iraq and Syria was what propelled the group 2 years ago. And if you look at what drew these foreign fighters to the ranks, what brought their power, it was having success on the battlefield. And those fortunes have turned for the Islamic State. They're now retracting over the past 9 months in particular. And as they lose ground, they have to find other ways to inspire their ranks. At the same point, this is a 2 to 3 year problem that has already been developing for Europe. You have thousands of foreign fighters that have gone to Iraq and Syria, and it's natural that they would start to leave the theater and become an empowering external operations force, we would say, in the terrorism analysis space, meaning that they can now carry out attacks that they couldn't do 2 years ago. So this phenomenon of being squeezed in Syria and Iraq is going to force them to try and find success elsewhere. And Europe is the number one place to go to find success. An attack in Europe is worth two or three regionally in the Middle East. You can see the media attention that's been drawn to it, the way it stays in the press cycle for weeks and months. And the other thing is a successful attack in Europe inspires the network of Islamic State supporters around the world to conduct attacks on their own. So success breeds success. And as you saw with Paris in November and now with Brussels, I think they know this is a winning formula as they start to lose ground in Syria.
Well, play out the strategy for us, though, Clint. I mean, success breeds success until it doesn't. They were taking lots of turf in Iraq and Syria. Now, as you say, there's some retraction there. We saw Syrian troops going into Palmyra just in the last 24 hours. Play out the strategy. What's the goal over time of attacks in Europe? Is it just opportunistic? Keep yourself in the news cycle so you have more recruits? Or is there a bigger, longer-term goal?
I think it's two or three parts. The first one is, yes, it's opportunistic. They have the capacity to do it now. They have skilled combat veterans who can produce explosive devices on their own in Europe. It's something al-Qaeda never could do. They used to have to bring recruits to places like Pakistan, train them up, and send them back and hope they did it right. The Islamic State can now launch this sort of an attack repeatedly. But there's two other components to it. Syria and Iraq was the way that the Islamic State gained manpower and resources. They had an Islamic State that could tax, and they had lots of manpower coming in when they were winning. Those two things are going away in Syria and Iraq. So what they need now is, one, a new home. And you're seeing that as they're starting to send their foreign fighters either back home or to more than a dozen affiliates that they have around the world, Libya being one of particular concern.
Need a new home, but Europe as a home or just as a recruiting fire?
No, as a recruiting fire. And that's what I was trying to get to with the manpower issue is if you can't find success in Syria and Iraq, you have to find success somewhere else. And that success brings more recruits to your ranks, either to you directly or to your affiliates. And it also starts to bring another resource support line, which is the diaspora community, that global community of Islamic State supporters that begin to want to fund either locally or in different regions those attacks and those groups that are around them. So you have to do something to sort of put yourself on the map to show that you're demonstrating progress. If you look at Al-Qaeda 10 years ago, they really lost their way, and as they lost their way in terms of having successful attacks, they lost their manpower and they lost their funding. And that's really how the Islamic State eclipsed them over the past 5 years.
ISIS looking for new battlegrounds and finding them in Europe. Here's the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, at a press conference last week saying, talking about forming a security union to fight terrorism in Europe. Again, interpreted by Ruply TV.
We need a security union. We need everything that will allow us to achieve a security union. All those elements have been presented by the European Council, and I do hope that the Council of Ministers will adopt the Commission proposals soon when it comes to protecting external borders.
Christina Shoyliang there in Europe. I want to ask you about how Europe may try and respond here, but a couple of callers first, if I may, from Providence, Rhode Island. Rebecca is on the line. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I actually just got back from Paris yesterday evening, and my question is sort of a rhetorical one because I was walking around and I was in the Louvre. I mean, everywhere you were in Paris, there were police on the corners. I mean, even in the smaller neighborhoods. But especially, like, you know, walking around the Louvre, I mean, within inside the Louvre, there were mostly men, military, with, you know, huge AK-47s across their chest. And I've never seen that in a Louvre before. And my question is, like, I hate to admit it, but it makes you feel better when you're in those places. But my question is that the answer? Because, you know, that's also frightening to see that and to see the size of those guns and that presence within a place like the Louvre.
Made you feel more secure. On the other hand, just to think of the necessity of that inside an art museum, no less, deeply disconcerting in its own way. Christina Shoyliang, talk to us about the layers here. Anybody who's been in Europe, especially Paris recently, has seen that. Heavily armed police, military in the center of the city. But that you can't have that everywhere all the time. What are the layers that will be required to respond here?
Well, I think it's most important is that we talk about prevention. I mean, instead of just chasing down and fighting terrorists now, we need to think about how can we prevent new terrorists from being created. And we're spending, I think, too much time on you know, chasing down these cells, when in fact we need to stop the recruitment. And I think that's the key right now, stopping the recruitment.
That sounds necessary and important, but you have an imminent threat, Clint, at the same time.
Right. I think a lot of the armed responses that we see, whether it's the United States, you know, Canada or Europe, is a lot of counterterrorism theater. I mean, it comes after an attack, not before. Mm-hmm. And those physical security measures, while they may make the public feel secure, are not nearly as important as the investigative functions. And that's where it's really fallen down in Europe. I think the French are actually very strong in that capacity, but you have a very uneven capacity across Europe. A lot of these smaller countries, Belgium being one, the Netherlands, Denmark, had a large number of foreign fighters go to Iraq and Syria. And they have now come back home, either, you know, in their own countries or in neighboring countries. And really, prevention at this point is about having a strong investigative capacity where there's limitless intelligence sharing and rapid response. And we don't have that in Europe. So they can put armed guards in front of every symbolic target. But when you look at it, the Islamic State has done something that Al-Qaeda never did. And that is they have turned away from symbolic targets. And instead of hitting a major monument, they're now hitting you in your neighborhood. And that's really creating a different dynamic in terms of terrorism. And that's why I think it's a lot of theater with our counterterrorism. We're putting physical security and force protection measures at targets that we really don't know if the Islamic State is looking at or not.
I want to look at how that a deeper response might work. Joe in Athol, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just came back from 3 years in Germany,
yeah.
And I feel comfortable in saying that people are not responding to this in any real significant manner in terms of changes in daily lives. I really think that what happened in America after 9/11 is a precursor of what's going to happen over there. The 9/11 Commission recommended one thing above all others, which was the ability for emergency responders and first responders and law enforcement to be able to speak to each other so that we could avoid some of the problems that took place. That really has not happened here. And you look at why Brussels was hit. They don't even speak the same language to each other. You have police officers that don't talk the language of the people that they're going in to investigate. And I don't see that changing in Europe in any significant way. They don't even commit. They don't even pay the 2% they've committed to NATO in terms of funding worldwide protection from threats. And they simply aren't going to get their act together. And I honestly believe, and I'm curious as to your guest thoughts, I honestly believe that the only realistic long-term response is open borders, armed civilians.
Joe, I don't know about that. I mean, that sounds Wild West, certainly not like a European dream. But don't you think attacks like we saw last week in Brussels are sufficient to get Europe's attention to bring change, Joe?
Honestly, I don't believe so. The Germans still think it's never going to happen there, with the exception of a small handful. I have some good friends over there but then they turn to the extreme, like AfD, the AfD party over there, the anti-immigration party.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the only reasonable people jump to the other side of the equation, and I think the vast majority of people still have a mindset that it simply cannot happen in their neighborhood.
Joe, I appreciate your call. We've heard that from Americans looking on. Over the weekend, we saw on Facebook the Nation, Republican Congressman Michael McCaul out of Texas, who is chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the U.S. Congress House, said Europe just isn't prepared. It's pre-9/11.
I think in many ways, I think Europe is in a pre-9/11 posture. They have many intelligence and security gaps.
But we've got them talking about a new security union. We heard Jean-Claude Juncker there, president of the European Commission. Christina, do you see something like that in the works? Is there a pan-European, stronger security net that might be laid down? Or this is coming at a time when Europe sometimes seems to be falling apart. Does it have the unity to put together a unified security front?
Not at the moment. And I think what your other guests have alluded to, and I think is really important, is that we're throwing a blind eye to the threat. I mean, here we have an attack in the heart of Europe, in the heart of international Europe, in a sense that this is where headquarters of NATO and the European Union are. And the Belgian government has failed the Belgian people and the international community. If you look at it, the threat there has been in the works for many, many years. There was the Sharia for Belgium website that was basically trying to radicalize young Belgians for years. They just shut it down. It's a network that has been in the making for years, and I think the Belgian government just was not willing or incapable to deal with this massive buildup of recruitment. And now all these returning foreign fighters that are coming back are impacting the disenfranchised youth within the ghettos in Belgium. And again, the security services, the forces that they have, they are not even able to recruit people to do the job. And I think this is what's frightening, is that there's just not the capacity building that needs to be done right now on the ground to help build a strong security. And Europe is as strong as its weakest link, and Belgium is an extremely weak link. You know, it has very strong France on its border, with a very powerful counterterrorism like Germany and the UK. But it's these weak countries like Belgium and the Netherlands and Denmark that are now just building up their counterterrorism strategies. And this is a little bit late in the game, and I think it's very unfortunate.
Clint, do you see sufficient impetus in this 1-2 punch of Paris in November and now Brussels to change that dynamic, to get Europe to step up unified security efforts?
I don't. I think it's very uneven. I think certain countries are going to take it very serious. I think France has. They've now suffered two attacks. The United Kingdom has for over a decade, since 2005 when they suffered their attacks. But these smaller countries, where are they going to, you know, amass the resources? Where are they going to get the actual capability? Not just, you know, in terms of technical capability, but also the talent to do these investigations. There hasn't been sufficient buildup, and there's generally, I think, an unwillingness to bring in people from the outside oftentimes. And so unless they can really get all those pressures moving, I think we'll see more of the same.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at Europe's security future, how it's going to cope with a problem that can look out of control sometimes, certainly looked really bad last week as bombs hit Brussels. The airport there still closed as we speak in the following week today. And, of course, subway attack in the center of town there. 38 dead, the latest number, hundreds wounded. Clint Watts is with us from the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Christina Choi-Liang in Geneva at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. You can join us this hour. Are you headed to Europe this spring, this summer? Do you have second thoughts at all? Do you buy? Pentagon claims that they're getting ISIS on the run a little bit, back on its heels. Does that make ISIS more dangerous in Europe or abroad? What does Europe do here? Here's a news conference on Friday at the Pentagon. This was U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter saying the U.S. is systematically eliminating the top officials in ISIS. Said it's believed that they had killed a senior ISIS leader who was serving as finance minister.
The removal of this ISIS leader will hamper the organization's ability to conduct operations both inside and outside of Iraq and Syria. This is the second senior ISIL leader we've successfully targeted this month.
Okay, down they go there. But in Europe, big problems. Here's Jan Jambon. Jambon, the Belgian interior minister, at a press conference on Thursday saying a number of areas of weakness in the Belgian security system, interpreted here by PBS.
If you put everything in a row, then you can say that you can indeed ask big questions in a number of areas about the Justice Department and the developments afterwards, and also about the police.
That's a lot of questions. He offered his resignation after the Brussels attacks. That was not accepted. Lots of questions for you, Clint and Christina. Tim in Montreal, Canada. Tim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, I wanted to say Canada picked and chose who they're going to take as refugees over from Syria and did security checks on them and sort of did that screening and vetting that Europe wasn't able to do. We should keep in mind that over a million refugees came into Germany, and many politicians, maybe some of them on the right, are asking how many of those refugees that have come in might become potential ISIS operatives or terrorists in the future. Thank you, sir.
And we had neo-Nazis in the streets of Brussels today at the impromptu memorial there for victims of this attack last week. Christina, what about this flow? Are people tracing it back to refugees, or is it primarily European citizens who have gone and returned?
Yeah, the threat is multifaceted. We have the internal threat, you know, the homegrown threat. There's the fear, you know, that refugees will contribute to the threat. But if you look at statistics, these are threats that have been created internally. These are French people. These are Belgian people. These are coming from migrant ghettos that have felt both social and economic deprivation and have not assimilated, and thus they're now being manipulated by these very smart, strategic recruiters. The Islamic State, I look at it as almost like a young startup company, because they're really marketing their resources and they're savvily finding the people that are the weakest, and they're recruiting them. And I think this is the network that we have to stop. It's the prevention, because we can go after the people that have already radicalized, but what about the next generation? We need to learn to assimilate our migrant communities and stop this vacuum that is has created, that has been filled now by these recruiters and who are using these, manipulating these young people to join the movement.
A real cultural challenge for Europe that has apparently, you know, ghettoized too many for too long, and now there may be a part of a price to pay here. Imran in Westboro, Massachusetts. Imran, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Well, I think your guest Christina stole my thunder, so maybe I'll pick up my second point, which is I think that in my mind, it really seems to reflect almost gang culture that you see here in the U.S., where recruitment is really around trying to get disaffected youth. It's around people who don't have a lot of hope in the system and want to lash out at the system. And so what I wonder is if there is a solution in Europe. Is it to approach this as if you were approaching gangs and gang culture? I mean, I think I read in Foreign Policy magazine that they have jihadi rap, you know. Mm. So this is, in my mind, I think it's kind of moved beyond just kind of the war and the weapons and the tactics to almost like a culture. And so the question is, how do you diffuse and break down the culture?
And maybe you have to do a number of things at one time. Imran, I appreciate your call, and that's a good question. Clint, what do you say? The cultural piece, the gang parallel here, you put that along, though, with a group in no small part behind this, calling itself a state. How do the pieces fit together, Clint?
I agree a lot with what Imran just said. There's a big difference between the Al-Qaeda of last decade and what we're seeing with these Islamic State foreign fighters, in that they're less committed or joined ideologically and more joined sociologically and more egotistically. You see a lot of this in the social media space when you watch Islamic State supporters. It's more about their fame and their legend and really being part of a community as much as it is about this ideological component. Al-Qaeda 10 years ago always worked really hard to bring in refined recruits without criminal records who were very devoted to the ideology. The Islamic State has in many ways pursued the reverse, which is we will take anybody. And you'll see that a lot of these people in Paris and Belgium who conducted the attacks have criminal records. You'll also note that they have strong bonds and relationships both before and after they went to Syria. Mm-hmm. And you see less of the martyrdom type videos. I mean, they're still out there, but that was always a mainstay of an Al-Qaeda attack, was this constant barrage of martyrdom videos and talking to the ideology and what would be achieved by pursuing this violent attack. I think he's exactly right. You see more criminality. You see more social bonds. You see more gang-type behavior. I think that's all sort of speaks to how the devolution of this jihad has become more of a mainstream sort of culture thing, like you mentioned it in the West.
But with death and injury tolls that far surpass what we see in, you know, single gang encounters, at least in this country and certainly in Europe, I want to look more at that. Bruce in Boston. Bruce, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What about the nuclear biological chemical threat of ISIS? And wasn't there a report of the Belgian terrorist planning to kidnap a nuclear scientist? How serious is that threat?
Christina, we saw reports over the weekend of concern about Belgium's nuclear facilities, and you heard the range of threats that Bruce describes.
Yes, it's very disturbing. You must have seen that one of the nuclear reactors is now put in question or is under a severe guard. Two of the employees who used to work there left to join for Al-Nusra Front, and then they joined ISIS. So they are obviously they would know how the workings of the plant works, and they don't know, or they fear one of them has died, but they don't know what happened to the other one. So this is very disturbing. I also look at one of the threats now that they are in the future might attack building up their cyber caliphate, and we could perhaps think about a future attack having a cyber element to it. We've already seen that they have attacked the American electronic grid, which is very disturbing. So I think this is something that we also have to worry about is their cyber capabilities.
So, Clint, you put all these threats together and the proximity of the ISIS home turf and the number of people coming back. And I mean, if Europe was going to get very serious about this, keeping in mind all its values, its political values, its value on liberty, but structurally, culturally, how would you construct a real response to this?
The first thing I would do is construct a task force. What they're instead probably going to do is try and build a bureaucracy. And bureaucracies are slow. Usually by the time they're built and effective, the problem is already long past. And this is something near term. I think the European Union needs to come together immediately and put someone, some entity in charge of running down the Islamic State as they move into the country. The next thing would be intelligence sharing, very uneven intelligence sharing across Europe, very uneven capacity. And those two things are essential. As you heard, I think, at the start of your broadcast, different languages being spoken, different databases, countries putting different levels of effort into it. You could look 2 to 3 years ago, we could track thousands of foreign fighters coming from Europe that were in the social media space, in the open source, this openly available information. You could see them leaving and going. It's kind of astounding that we're not picking these people back up once they move into country. And then the last part, I think, is investigative know-how and reach. And right now, there are only a few countries, Germany, France, the UK, that have really strong investigative capacity in counterterrorism. They need to be matched up at a local level with these places where we know there are hotspots for foreign fighter recruitment. I can map those myself on my laptop at home. The Europeans have to be able to do that on their own, in their own local communities. And so it's a little disturbing that they can't amass their own resources. They can't put the most effective investigators in there. I think France has got a lot to offer the Belgians. I think the Germans and the UK have tons of experience running down terrorists over many decades. And we got to get them integrated with those local communities in the smaller European countries.
Christina, do you see that coming? Do you see that happening? That kind of heightened, hyper-heightened coordination and maybe even some sort of security czar at the head of it? Or would Europeans resist that as against civil liberties, against national boundaries?
I think the threat that has happened in Brussels has really heightened the alarm. And I see several steps that I think are really important. One is when we talked about the scene, these groups are similar to criminal gangs. I think it's important that we focus a lot more on human intelligence. In the past, we've worked a lot on electronic surveillance, and I think we're too highly dependent on it. And if you look at, for example, ISIS with the Snowden effect, they are now using encrypted technologies, end-to-end encryption, so we're going blind. And I think this is one of the biggest problems of our police forces is they feel more and more pressure because there is a breakdown in basically seeing what is happening on the ground. So I think we need a lot more human intelligence, a lot more intelligence sharing. I think we have to reduce some of our strong legislation in privacy because, I mean, I think it's important to say that people have a right to privacy, but people should also have the right to stay alive. So it's important that we work harder together in that domain. Another domain that I think is really important that we're ignoring is this crime-terror nexus. As you can see, the Islamic State has a magazine called Dabiq, and they basically announced in their Dabiq magazine that they like when people go to jail because there they can use these people then to recruit others. So our prisons have become incredible places for recruitment. And if you can see, of all the attackers, 80% of them had a criminal background. And I don't think our police forces are as aware as they should be about this growing crime-terror nexus, which is also facilitating their access to arms and the ingredients to make explosives, and even the ability to get fake identities and passports to travel. So I think we need to look much closer at this crime-terror nexus, and this is a key to cracking down on terrorism.
Christina, we had a caller earlier suggesting that Europe just doesn't want to confront this. It wants to put its head in the sand and maybe pretend that it's not there. Do you see that changing or sense that, no, let's not get too upset here, let's just keep on keeping on and this will somehow burn itself out?
I think at the European Union level, it's becoming a lot more important, but also at the global level. If you look at the initiatives now that are happening at the United Nations level, the PVE initiative, Preventing Violent Extremism, at the global level, bringing in all our international players, I think is critical, because Europe is very much not just an island. We are part of the global community. And if we don't work with our partners in the Middle East and with the entire global community, we will never get our arms around preventing violent extremism. So I think we can learn from each other. There's a lot of great new initiatives, the Resolve Network, which has been created to build a network of researchers to get real nuanced research on the ground on how to prevent violent extremism, in order that we have much better answers on how to prevent it. So this is the key. I think at the international level, at the United Nations level, there's now a lot of work being done. There's going to be a big meeting on April 7th and 8th. That is being led by the Swiss government and the United Nations on a global initiative on how to prevent violent extremism at the global level.
Clint, so forgive me, Christina. Clint, we just got a minute here. How do you see the stakes? Is it eternal Europe? It rolls on no matter what happens here, or something else?
I think it rolls on. The Islamic State, even though they are larger than any foreign fighter migration we've ever seen, only has so much capacity. And so you've seen a large network run its course here, and I think it'll be tracked down. I'm sure that there's some additional networks in Europe of some capacity for the Islamic State. So I think it runs its course. I think the issue really comes down to the larger impact, which is now you've got thousands of foreign fighters, both from Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, that are going to empower additional attacks and additional networks. This is an enduring problem, and the real question is, does Europe come together to fight this, or do they break apart and really become more isolated? And that's what I'm looking to evaluate over the next few months.
Well, the whole world watching that question, not least a lot of Americans with long ties there, and as Christina says, it matters to everyone. We wish that community good luck with this. We know it's not easy, and there are big values at stake. Clint Watts with the Foreign Policy Research Institute with us from New York today. Clint, thank you so much for joining us. And Christina Shorey-Liang at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Christina, thank you for joining us from Geneva.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. Tomorrow we'll look at taxes and the 2016 pledges around them as you file yours. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.